Call the Health and Human Services Finance Division to order. Is Senator Rust here yet? I don't believe that she is, and I've checked. Senator Rosen is second on the agenda, and she's willing to go first, and so we'll take Senator Rust's bill when she gets here. Senator Rosen, Senate File 469. Just to orient members, we do have a long agenda today. You know, I know on the schedule it's 8:30 to 11, but we don't have session today or anything. We're going to try to stay here and wrap up this agenda. It includes a couple of bills that got bumped from last night's hearing, 1272 and 1342, Senator Hayden's bills. So those got tacked onto the agenda last night. And with that brief intro, welcome to the table, Senator Rosen. Let's hear Senate File 469.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. Senate File 469 is the Chemical Health Navigation Program. And for many of you, you are familiar with this because the pilot project that started off in Washington County and 10 counties in southeast Minnesota was in 2009. It allowed the counties to work with DHS to permit case managers or navigators, basically, to spend consolidated chemical dependency treatment funds dollars on non-treatment services, such as some of the other navigator services, ancillary needs that involve education, housing, employment. And that was extremely successful. With this Senate File 469, Mr. Chair and members, we are looking at taking it more on a statewide basis. This did go through Health and Human Services Policy Division, but there has been continued work on this bill since then to make all the department and the stakeholders more comfortable with that. Mr. Chair, I do have the A2 amendment.
Okay. I don't see that in our packets, maybe. Is it?
Okay. No,
it's right here. Oh, okay. Does everybody have the A2 amendment?
Okay.
No, it's being handed out. Okay. Maybe you can... Is this the first time you've heard this bill, Senator Rosen?
Mr. Chair, we heard it in Senator Sharon's committee.
Okay, so then this we'd have to describe the amendment and then adopt it. So on the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are just some significant, well, not significant. The department expressed concerns about just having a blanket statewide pilot project. So they really geared it down, worked with the stakeholders that are already involved in the first pilot project to make sure that it that they define some of the rules of people that can perform or participate in it. They designated three pilot projects, one for the northern region, one for the metro, and one for the southern region. And they just worked, and I'd like to congratulate the department and the stakeholders for really working on, I think there was like 11 drafts of these changes from Senator Sharon's hearing to this hearing to make sure that things are accountable and going forward. So with that, that's about the A2 amendment. If you'd like, I'd like to have Mr. Harder explain further on the amendment, if you'd like
sure.
Further clarification.
Mr. Harder, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kelly Harder, and I come here on behalf of MACSA and MICA to support this bill. I want to, and committee members, thank you for allowing us to come here. You know, I want to start by thanking and appreciating Senator Sharon for allowing us to. Rosen, I'm sorry, Sharon, I'm looking right at you. That was your committee.
It happens all the time, and I take it as a compliment to be confused with Senator.
Rosen. Glad that's on the record. Sorry, Senator Rosen. But anyway, I want to thank her for that. Here's the framework of the bill. The first section, 250 of the amendment. 254B.13 allows the good work in the current navigator pilots that are happening in Washington and in the southeast counties to continue. And then what we also do in 254B.14 is formally move forward our arrangement with counties and the Department of Human Services in partnership with providers as well, in looking at ways by which we learn from those navigators to a population that really does stress our public dollar system at times, and how do we implement those lessons learned into a continuation of new, innovative, and different models for chemical health. It is about integration, as it is in so much of what you hear in front of your committee, whether it's primary health care, behavioral health, and in this context, chemical health as well. So this allows us to work with the department. It formalizes the relationship, selecting three pilots to happen, one in the north, south, and also in the metro, and our commitment to develop the program design and then report back to you next year would be our hope that we sit here and tell you the progress we've made.
And Senator Rosen, just to orient members, this is a delete everything amendment. And so the Senate Council summary and the bill that we have don't describe it. And the fiscal note that's been handed out, are there, does it change
Mr. Chair,
fiscal implications?
That is from the department. I need to have clarification because this was the fiscal note that was for the current bill.
Right. This is drafted to the first engrossment,
right.
And so this is a delete everything, and I'm curious.
And
so as we're trying to...
And I'm surprised, Mr. Chair, that they have not got the delete all everything fiscal note available, but they were trying to get this neutral,
okay.
Because there should be no FTEs on this, and Max and Micah will be developing the criteria, working with the department to develop the outcome measures on this going forward. So, I think we'll, if you don't mind, Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Rosen. So if you're is it your intention that this stay and be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the
yes.
omnibus bill? So,
yes.
I mean, work to get the fiscal note 2-0 could continue mm-hmm. at that point as long as you're not hoping to leave here today. So, I mean, before we're done with the testimony, we can bring the department up and ask them.
That'd be great, Mr. Chair.
You know, how the fiscal implications work in regards to the A2 amendment.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've had it described to us. Does any questions of members on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Rosen renews her motion that the A2 amendment be adopted. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator
Chair,
Rosen, did you have additional testimony?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Heather Gertz, who is the pilot project director for the Southwest or Southeast area of the program. We just would like to highlight a few of the successes and the outcomes that we need to continue this project.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Heather Gertz, and members of the committee, Mr. Chair, I'm the clinical director at Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center, and I've directly supervised the Southeast Minnesota CD pilot project for the past 2 years. Thank you for the opportunity this morning to address the committee. And in my testimony, as Senator Rosen said, I'm going to share some of the key outcomes and a few success stories from the pilot project that we've been conducting. The Southeast Minnesota City Pilot Project has provided intensive services to 81 individuals since the start of the pilot. These individuals have had a combined total of 221 detox admissions in the 2 years prior to their participation in our pilot. This number decreased by more than 50% in the 2 years that the pilot has been going on. As of December 31st, the participants in the pilot have only had 99 detox admissions since entering the pilot. And more than 25% of these detox admissions came from one individual who really is serving as a data outlier. Conversely, more than half of the individuals have not had any detox admissions. The detox costs per day in Olmsted County are $326. So if you add up the decrease in the number of days, that's a savings of approximately $80,000. One individual that is in the pilot had 134 lifetime detox admissions prior to the pilot, but since entering the pilot 2 years ago, has only had 2 admissions into detox. Additionally, looking at treatment recidivism, these individuals had a total of 275 treatment episodes in the 2 years prior to their participation in the pilot. This number has also dramatically decreased upon participation in the pilot, as the individuals have only had 33 treatment episodes since entering the program. More significant, I think, even than that, is that 72% of the individuals in the program have not required any treatment since entering the pilot. And treatment in this instance is being classified as inpatient, outpatient, or halfway house placement. There have also been significant results regarding housing and employment. 56% of the clients were homeless prior to the project. Within the first year, all but one were housed. Only four clients were actively employed when entering the pilot, but after participating, 69% of the clients are actively employed, enrolled in school, or are volunteering. I'm also just going to give a couple stories. The first is of Jane. Jane entered the Navigator pilot project a little over 2 years ago. When she entered the program, she was homeless and on a CD commitment as a result of being found sleeping under a bridge in zero-degree weather. The pilot helped her transition from inpatient treatment to a halfway house, then to a sober board and lodge. After about a year, Jane was able to transition into her own independent apartment, where she still resides and is doing well. This summer, Jane was reunited with her daughter, who she hadn't seen in over 5 years due to her chronic chemical use and inability to achieve sobriety. Jane now has daily phone contact with her daughter and has had several face-to-face visits. Jane is going to school to get her GED. She plans on getting a job working in a detox or something similar because she wants to help people, other people, overcome what she has. And she has now had over 2 years of sobriety. The second story is of Susan. She was in the CD pilot project for about 24 months. In the 2 years prior to being admitted to the pilot, she had 8 different treatment episodes. She was on probation at the time she entered the pilot, and she was unemployed. Her drug of choice was crack cocaine, and upon admission to the pilot, the county was both the payee for her and her son's disability income. Since entering the pilot, Susan has maintained her sobriety. She's been employed at least part-time during the majority of the past 24 months. She's been able to prove that she's capable of managing her money and regain control of her income as the payeeship was removed. And she's also currently in process of having the payeeship removed from her son's income also. My final story is of Jill. She started our program in July of 2011. In the 2 years leading up to her referral to our program, she had 3 total treatments, but 11 in her lifetime. She was on probation and started the program because she assaulted a police officer. And she had several relapses that led to a probation violation. During the course of our program, she accomplished many things. She started outpatient treatment and a monitored and abuse program. Now, 18 months later, she's completed her outpatient treatment, continues to take anabuse voluntarily, completed probation in December, and continues to see her therapist and her psychiatrist. And she's been sober since December of 2011, which is 14 months. With the support of the Navigators and other services that were set up for Jill, she's developed independent skills, such as being able to pay her bills on time, make phone calls for appointments, and arrange her appointments to complete all of the paperwork that's necessary. All of which before this pilot she was unable to do. I hope that these statistics and stories have demonstrated to you the success of this program and the need to continue the work that we have started. Due to the great successes in both Washington County and the Southeast Minnesota pilot project, it would be wonderful to see these services offered statewide or at least in other pilot projects to show the continued work. Thank you for the opportunity to participate in this pilot project since 2010, and I'm here today to ask for your support in allowing the state and counties to continue to work together to implement this project, which will lead to a better use of county and state tax dollars. I stand for questions from the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Kurth, for the stories of success, and thank you, Senator Rosen, for your continued efforts toward this. And, I guess I'm going to want to – is there questions from members for the testifiers? I'm going to want to get DHS to talk about the fiscal note a little bit, if there's somebody here.
Mr. Chair, David Hartford from the department.
Mr. Hartford, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Senator Dave Hartford, Assistant Commissioner for Chemical and Mental Health Services. And just to speak to the great work that's been done in these pilot programs over the last 3 years, but these pilot projects were designed in an era prior to where we are with healthcare reform and looking at what are all of the potential changes, because we have a very lively healthcare environment today. So as we in the department looked at going statewide and embracing the concepts that and a lot of the services that were put out in the Navigator program, really seeing this adjustment and looking forward to not the original design, but keeping these original pilot, the original pilots going at the same time, starting three additional pilots that would really take some of the opportunities that we see in the environment moving forward. Just to make that clear, that there was three new pilots that take into account the model of care report that was just released this past week, and the concepts are that are embedded in that document, and moving forward into the three new projects. With that, to get to the point of the fiscal note,
okay,
that this is, we were negotiating right to just a couple of days ago this this amended language, and so the it would be a zero fiscal note attached to the going forward with these amendments.
Excellent. I mean, it looks to me like it went right till 6:30 this morning, based on the timestamp at the top of the
amendment. Yes, Mr. Chair,
amendment.
That's accurate.
Yes, okay.
So, Mr. Chair, I was a little surprised at this one because this was based off the bill that went through Senator Sharon's. So.
Okay. Well, with that, any other further questions of members? Seeing none, thank you for your excellent work, and we will still lay this over for possible inclusion. Senator Rust, Senator Rust will be next, but Senator Rosen, she's just a zealot here or something. I don't know. Senator Rosen moves that Senate file 469, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, members.
And I believe Senator Rust is here, and I do need to say we're going to try to finish at a reasonable hour today, and I have had requests from several members and several members from the community as well to really work on trying to be efficient with our time and focusing on the finance aspects of bills. We've gotten tied up a few times with very, very lengthy, I believe productive conversations, but we need to really try to limit testimony to 2 to 3 minutes per testifier and limit the number of testifiers per bill if we can, just to make sure that we're respectful of everybody's time and we're able to all stay for all of the bills here. If we run significantly over time, we've had to short other important proposals in their time to testify and had a couple fall off the end of agendas. So if we can be as efficient as possible with time, that will help all of us. With that, Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 1302 is a bill that appropriates $225,000 each year from lottery proceeds, prize funds, to the Department of and Commissioner of Human Services, who a few years back took over the oversight of dealing with problem gambling. And it allows, as you well know, you're very familiar with this, allows that appropriation then to fund the state affiliate of the National Council on Problem Gambling, which is a gambling-neutral organization working with the gambling industry, working with those that are involved in helping problem gamblers. And the lottery, there's a letter in your folders. The lottery is in very much of support of this. They've already set aside the funds to transfer to the Department of Human Services. The executive director of the North Star Alliance is here. If you have any questions, if you don't, we just have the bill in front of us.
Excellent. Any questions of members? This is an appropriation that's been a longstanding appropriation.
Since 2007. This is 6 years ago it started.
It changed handlers a couple of years ago, and now it's coming back to DHS. Any further questions of members?
Move the bill.
I'm wondering, there is a council reminds me, there is a line at the bottom of this that says this is a one-time appropriation, and we do go through this every couple of years, and I don't know as we need to. I mean, I think that gambling is, you know, something that is been around for a long time in Minnesota, and it's probably going to be around for a long time. All indications are, and problem gambling will be a part of that, and we will need to keep on top of it. Maybe if somebody was interested, we could delete line 1.13. Senator Sharon moves to delete line 1.13, which says this is a one-time appropriation, and that would just allow us to carry this in the base budget, and if we needed to take a look at it, if things changed so that we should remove it at some point, we could do that. So any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Sharon's motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
I'm also willing to move Senate file number 1302.
Senator Sharon moves Senate file 1302 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you
Senator
much,
Rust.
Mr. You. Chairman and members, you're very generous.
Senator Eaton, with Senate file 1031. Welcome to the committee, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members will find a handout in their packets for this bill.
Mr. Chair, should I begin?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I have Senate file 1031. This is a bill to put some funding back into the mental health grants for providing supportive housing for people with mental illness. I was actually part of the initiatives that we started in the late 90s. I went out as a nurse into the community from the regional treatment center, and as did many. We took many positions out of the treatment centers as we were eliminating beds there and moving people into the community. And in 2006, 2007, they decided that they were going to appropriate the funds directly to the counties and no longer have state employees out in the communities. And with that, I was also on the Minnesota Nurses Association labor group, and I was at the table when they promised they would not take that money away once they'd appropriated it to the county. And I want you to know that the first thing they did in 2010 was take that money. And in 2008, I don't know if you received the document that shows that we had $3,896,559. Last year, we had $1,598. And
I don't think we have that. If you have copies, we could pass them out. And if you have just...
Okay. And it's... I mean, in 2009, it went in half. I mean, it went to about $1,500,000. So many of us who work in the mental health field felt this was a direct contradiction to what we had been promised. So I will at this point let Grace from Guild speak.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Guild.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Grace Tangyard-Schmidt, and I'm with Guild Incorporated. It's a private, not-for-profit community mental health agency in the metropolitan area. I also have a handout, which I'll refer to in just a couple of minutes. I'll speak just generally about supportive housing. We provide an array of recovery-focused community treatment and rehabilitation services for adults who have serious mental illnesses. And within this population, we serve those who have long-term histories of homelessness, experience other social complexities, the lack of employment and poverty, and who often have legal barriers to finding and keeping stable housing. when you've had trouble finding and keeping a permanent affordable place to live, moving to a place that offers support when you need it can really make a difference. Supportive housing is that combination of housing and services intended as a cost-effective way to help people lead more stable and productive lives. Supportive housing is widely believed to work well for those who face the most complex challenges to a successful life. Across the nation, research has shown that coupling permanent housing with supportive services is highly effective at achieving and maintaining housing stability. It helps improve health outcomes and decreases the use of publicly funded institutions. Supportive housing has been shown to be cost-effective, resulting in reductions in the use of shelter, ambulance, police, jail, health care, emergency rooms, behavioral health, and other service costs. Locally, Wilder Research has published a return on investment in supportive housing in Minnesota, which you may find helpful. Coming down to even a lower level, in our agency, the document that you just received, in our agency, the Hospital to Home Initiative is one example of a permanent supportive housing model. It is targeted to provide an alternative intervention for individuals who, for a variety of reasons, use a disproportionate amount of hospital emergency department and inpatient resources. This frequent use results in avoidable health care expenses and ties up emergency department rooms unnecessarily. Regions Hospital refers these folks to us, and we engage them in a plan to improve their health stability and quality of life. You'll see the most independent evaluation, which is what you just received. It shows emergency department use has consistently decreased over time, an 81% decline in 2 years. Despite long histories of homelessness, all participants moved into stable housing within 3 months of enrollment, and participants tended to have higher ratings of self-sufficiency. Funding for supportive housing helps us and others target this segment of the population and provide services tailored to their needs. Supportive housing helps individuals turn around a cycle of chronic homelessness and offers additional support for them. Thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you, Ms. Tanger-Schmidt. Probably not the first time you've been known as Ms. Guild, though, I bet. Oh.
That might be easier to pronounce.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I did my best.
Thank you.
Senator Eaton, you need to fill in the dollar appropriation. Do you have somebody, or do you have an amount to suggest?
I was hoping for the original grant, but we'll leave it to the committee.
Well, remind us again what the original grant was. We can probably put it in. It will be laid, this bill will
yes.
be laid over for possible inclusion, and any amounts are subject to what we're able to fit within our very difficult target. I mean, that
I
said,
understand.
We did have a good conversation yesterday, and I know we have several mental health bills coming up yet today, and we talked about how woefully inadequate the funding for support services, particularly stable housing for people with mental illness, are. So the amount?
He's got it. Thank you.
We have the handout now.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Eaton?
I would ask for the 2008 level if it can be found in your budget. And I do want to point out that as a professional out in the community, it was very difficult to be a nurse for someone if you couldn't find them. If they did not have permanent housing, they could be anywhere, couch hopping or whatever. And to keep people stable, they need their medications, they need their supports, they need groceries, and so on. And it's really hard to work with people without stable housing. So it's a big piece of what is working with our deinstitutionalization.
So Senator Sharon moves on line 1.6 to replace the blank dollar amount with $3.9 million. On that motion, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. On the bill, Senate File 1031. We just adopted the amendment to fill in the dollar amount. So we'll So Comes now we have 1031 before us. Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 1031, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair of the committee.
Now, we have folks who need to leave to go to the other body, so we need to hear Senate File 1077 next, if you're ready, Senator Rosen. Oh. Okay. We are handing out the most recent version of Senate File 1077. The version members will find in their packets is not the most recent version, so those will be handed out right now. With that, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, if you called me Senator Carlson, I would be upset, but Senator Rest and Senator Sharon is good. Just joking.
I'm trying.
I know. We're getting started here. 1077, members, is the opioid addiction treatment bill, or the methadone bill. This is the third stop on this bill. It was in Health and Human Services Policy Division. It has gone through Judiciary, and now it's in front of your division, Mr. Chair. There should be a zero fiscal note to this, but Mr. Jerry Kerber, the Inspector General, will speak to that. And he has to leave to go. So I do appreciate moving this up. I really do.
Yep.
But basically, this bill is is the result of two things, really. The Department of Human Services has put out their Minnesota State Substance Abuse Strategy, and this is part of that strategy. And you've all received it, and it's a very aggressive, very good strategy for drug abuse in the state going forward. Also, last fall, there was a treatment program in Duluth where there was an extreme case of lack of oversight at the clinics that dispensed the methadone. There was hearings last fall, and this is something that needs to be worked with. So the department and the stakeholders and the providers have worked very closely to develop this bill. And I should just say that methadone, a lot of people think, oh, there's different situations with methadone, it's bad, but it is still the most effective treatment for opioid addiction, and it is evidence-based. So it is part of our healthcare delivery system. This bill makes sure that we're doing it correct. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would just like to turn it over to Mr. Gerber to explain the cooperation and what the providers and the department have come up with.
Mr. Kerber, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office at the Department of Human Services. And as Senator Rosen said, this bill really came out of a number of problems that we were seeing throughout the state relative to methadone treatment programs. And one of the things that we discovered, and we've been doing a number of investigations, is that there's sort of a disjointed system of oversight, in that there are five different agencies that had oversight responsibilities, and with all are responsible, but nobody was ultimately accountable for the whole package. And so what we did is we proposed that the licensing standards and the regulatory standards from other bodies, like the DEA as a piece of it, SAMHSA, the federal organization, the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, accreditation agencies, and then us, what we're proposing here is that those standards, not all of them, but the ones that are most relevant, are also now moved in to be licensing standards that will be monitored and enforced by our agency. And it'll allow us to do a better job of kind of ongoing monitoring and then investigating when there's a problem that occurs. We initially drafted some legislation that was introduced, and since then we've been working very closely with the provider organizations, and there's 16 methadone treatment programs in Minnesota, and we've had a real collaborative effort here, and we've come to an agreement, and they would even testify in favor of it if you want to spend the time on it. I think the important thing to know here is that there is no cost to this. There was maybe going to be a cost. What we're doing is changing the way the prescription monitoring program is how that works in relationship to methadone treatment programs. What we're expecting is that methadone treatment programs will check against that prescription monitoring program before prescribing methadone to people, and then on a quarterly basis thereafter. But one of the things that's pretty exciting about this, too, is that we also put a provision in there that puts a little burden on the Department of Human Services to do some checking against the prescription monitoring program. Because we have information about who is actually enrolled in these programs, we're going to be doing routine checking against the prescription monitoring program and then alert the license holder, the medical director of the program, that somebody in their care is getting prescription meds from another source. Ideally, I think we would want the methadone treatment programs to be reporting to the prescription monitoring program so that other community physicians can see that they're getting methadone. But that bumps up against a whole history of confidentiality statutes that are in federal law to protect the identity of people getting chemical dependency treatment, and all for good reason. And so this is something we've come up with as an alternative. As I mentioned, Mr. Chair, there is no cost to this. We're working this out with the Board of Pharmacy.
Excellent. Any questions of members?
Mr. Chair, I do have the A9 amendment.
Senator Rosen, yes, the A9 amendment, I believe, has been passed out to members. Any questions on the A9 amendment? It looks like just some clarification language to me.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, clarification definitely guarantees that there will be a zero fiscal cost.
Okay.
Upon this.
Senator Rosen moves the A9 amendment. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Okay, so any other questions on the bill then? I think this one with a zero fiscal note would travel on its own and head to the floor. Well, head to full finance. You'll have to stop there because we're just a division.
Okay.
Senator, Mr. Kerber.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Ms. White has a slight oral amendment that she discovered is necessary. It's a editing issue.
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, members, on 6.29, delete only.
Mr. Chair, I move.
Senator Rosen moves the oral amendment on line 6.29, delete the word only. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, motion prevails. With that, Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 1077, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Senator Marty is up next. Is he in the room or close? Are his testifiers here? Not seeing him right now. So, Senator Sharon, are you ready with either of yours, 270 or 598?
Sure.
Take your preference.
Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to present Senate File 270.
Okay.
This is legislation that provides, and this is legislation that has been reviewed by the Policy Committee.
Yep.
So because I know there are some members here who are not on the Policy Committee, I'll briefly highlight what the bill does. It provides an exception to the drug formulary, which is a set of drugs that are allowed to be prescribed from for prescribers under certain conditions. And so this legislation provides an exception to the formulary for patients who are experiencing a first or second psychotic episode. Just contextually, this bill and others that you'll be hearing from me today have to do with improving the mental health system, and in particular here, intervening in crisis situations. If we do early intervention to interrupt the progression of a psychotic episode, we have better outcomes, and our failure to do it rapidly and quickly creates more difficulties across the whole spectrum. So the exception to the drug formulary allows these patients to receive a medication that they need very quickly and promptly without having to go through a bureaucratic process that goes on when you have to have an exception to the drug formulary. The bill also states the counties need to continue to provide, they must continue to provide case management services. I have an amendment in relationship to this today. In the policy committee, there were some concerns from the counties about this, and we have worked through language which will be offered to you in the amendment that works better for the counties in terms of how they are able to be responsive to the requests for young people that is implicated in this bill. But the idea is that we would allow people, even though they turn age 18, to stay on a program that whose services are better aligned with the needs of the person, and that they don't change simply because the person turns 18. So if that program continues to be important for the client, that they can stay on those case management services rather than transition into an adult process that occurs. Those two different processes of case management have different focuses and different emphases. And then finally, it provides appropriation for expanding statewide parent support outreach pilot program. That's to provide early intervention response approach to serve families with significant child maltreatment factors. Just as context, as you all have heard, at least certainly we have in the policy committee, when there's a review process for neglect or maltreatment, it is those who are most significantly at risk that proceed in the system in terms of intervention. There are a number of other families identified with high risk factors that do not meet that criteria, but certainly could use an intervention, and with that intervention and support might help us all provide a better environment for the children and for their future. So this allows an expansion for an earlier intervention before it hits that high crisis level in which the family is accused of being abusive or neglectful. It also, and the bill provides intensive treatment supports for adolescents experiencing their first psychotic episode. It provides training for mental health professionals on early psychosis, screening tools, and best practices for that appropriate intervention at the right time. And a very important part of this bill is an initiative that you've all heard about that has a lot of support in the state, and that's for the school-linked mental health services for children. This is funding that's targeted to providers so that they can serve in the schools the highest percentage of students that that have high risk, high poverty, high use of other kinds of intensive kinds of intervention processes. The school-linked mental health services for children provides grants for services which will be distributed throughout rural and urban communities. That was part of our conversation. It includes consultation services to school districts that want to collaborate with a community mental health provider. So that's essentially what's in the bill. You have a fiscal note, which is what we're here in part to discuss. But I would, if the committee has some time, the testifiers are aware that we're focused on the financial issues today and not the content or the public policy. But in order for you to understand the importance of the fiscal note, we do have some testifiers who would speak very briefly to the purposes of this bill.
Senator Sharon, before we move to the testifiers, as we work through this, you have the A2 amendment before us. Does that change the fiscal note?
It relates to the county's responsibilities as it relates in this bill, so it does not have an impact on the fiscal note.
So the fiscal note is valid whether or not we adopt the A2 amendment. Would
That's
you like
correct.
To adopt the A2 amendment?
I'd like to make a motion to approve the A2 amendment.
On Senator Sharon's motion on the A2 amendment, any questions or comments of members? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. All right. And Senator Sharon, your testifiers.
Please introduce yourselves and the subject that you'll be addressing.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Mark Sander. Thank you, Mr. Chair, senators, guests. I'm a clinical psychologist with Hennepin County and the Minneapolis Public Schools. And I've been in that joint appointment for the last 8 years. And in that role, I helped develop and implement and evaluate the school mental health program in Minneapolis. And I now support the countywide school mental health initiative. And I'm here to speak in support of Senate File 270 to increase funding for school-linked mental health. There's an urgent need to get children connected with the right level of care quickly. And school-linked mental health provides quick, convenient access to high-quality clinical mental health services. The school mental health programs in Minneapolis, Hennepin County, and across the state have shown over the past several years very positive outcomes for children and families. School-linked mental health has significantly decreased barriers to access, such as cost, transportation, and parents needing to take time off of work to get their children the treatment that they need. Data on the school-linked mental health programs over the last years has remained consistent, and it shows that we have increased access and quick access. 85% of the children identified are seen at least once face-to-face. 70% are seen within 10 days. Over half, this is their very first time receiving services. We're able to keep them engaged in care. They're seen an average of 17 times during one school year to get that good clinical dosage of treatment. And when we looked over multiple years, it's up to 25 clinical visits. So we really make sure they get the treatment that they need. Parents and teachers are reporting positive improvements in mental health functioning. We've seen significant decreases in suspensions and increase in attendance. And we've seen positive impact on academic achievement. Over the past 5 years, through the state school-linked grants, 20 grantees have served over 13,000 children, and over half of those children had never received treatment before. And of them that had not received services before, 45% or more were found to be seriously emotionally disturbed, meaning that they were at risk for out-of-home placement or hospitalization in the next year. These services really get kids engaged in care who need to get care. There's two important elements to this, and that's integrating that are supported by the grants, which is the on-site mental health professional being integrated into the school, and secondly, the ancillary services that allow for the consultation with the school staff to really integrate that treatment and the successful strategies into the school environment. This state appropriation has proven to be a great return on investment. Each state grant dollar leverages 2 to 4, sometimes 5 additional dollars of either health care dollars or local dollars to support the program. And because of these programs, many children and families have gotten a lot greater access to mental health treatment. In closing, school-linked mental health has proven results, has shown we know how to make school-linked mental health work and be successful, and we ask that you support Senate File 270. This is one of the wisest investments of state funding to support students and families in a long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sander, for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senate committee members. My name is Chua Zhang. I am a volunteer at National Alliance for Mental Illness and a person living with a mental illness. Did you guys hear me fairly well?
Yep.
Okay. The first time I encountered and faced the challenges of my bipolar disorder was at the age of 16. The symptoms were difficult to manage while in high school because I would blame myself for being depressed for many days for multiple months. I was disengaged in the class and antisocial with my friends, and at times could not pick up my pencil to do my homework at home. I kept this all to myself. I felt less normal as the symptoms persisted throughout my senior year in high school. In reflection, I wish that my high school could have sought out or provided a psychologist at least to support me in talk therapy and to formally diagnose me with depression. then I would have been able to get resources and clinical therapy. The treatment and interventions that I would have been able to receive would have helped me before my three hospitalizations in a cycle of a year from 18 to 19 years old. Therefore, I would have not spent my nights contemplating my own thoughts and actions throughout the day in high school, which were positives and strengths of mine that led to a negative and self-defeating attitude or self-esteem. Also, the pain and anguish I caused my parents and siblings were almost excruciating because I could not pick up myself during the depression while all of them made their best effort to counsel or comfort me. At this time, my family, nor did I not know when, not know what was wrong with me and felt that it was just a phase that older teenagers went through. It was the first time my family and I have ever been through together, and at times it felt hopeless. As I mentioned before, I was hospitalized three times during the course of my freshman year in college at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul. In the hospital, I was officially diagnosed with major depression during my first hospitalization and the second time with bipolar disorder type 1. I felt my dream of being in college was shattered and over as I withdrew from school only 4 weeks into my freshman year in college, as I was a first-generation college student and first of my family to attend school. As I reflect, the hospital bill was overwhelming for me and even more for my family. Although I was under my parents' employer's insurance, we had to pay thousands of dollars out of pocket to cover my hospital bills. Financially, I was fortunate enough because my parents both were employed at the time. But as I think back and look at the many families, sons, daughters, who often don't have health insurance coverage or no support in their plan to cover mental health. And therefore, we as persons living with a mental health condition are normal, but in periods of time in our life, we have to climb mountains or hills by ourselves with all the elements against us, which are natural forces that we cannot control. In my lifetime, a 26-year-old, the greatest achievement that I can recollect was graduating from college from the University of St. Thomas with a bachelor's degree in social work when having to struggle with bipolar throughout college. It showed my character and dedication to my dream to prove to myself that I can overcome anything in life and still live with bipolar.
Mr. Young, I'm glad you're able to come and share your story with us today.
Thank you.
It means a lot to us. Senator Sharon, do you have additional testifiers?
One more testifier. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. My name is Nancy Lindquist. I'm the RN coordinator for the First Episode program at the University of Minnesota. It's a special program that has been funded through grant money, but I know that we are very small. We're very fledgling, and we don't advertise because I'm the only care manager there, and I can only handle so many people. But I do know the benefits of intervening early make total sense to me. I think this should be common sense because we don't wait until somebody's stage 4 cancer to step in and help. This is kind of a real critical time with the first episode to get in there and start working with somebody and get them engaged. Decrease the duration of this untreated psychosis because right now we're at about 18 months of untreated. It's a time where disability and the illness just flourishes. So if we can get in early, we can engage them. Right now we're working with about 127 people directly with the residents and our medical director and myself. And we have family therapy, we have individual therapy, we have group therapy that hits cognitive behavioral therapy, resiliency training, and socialization. We've just developed another program that's going to be grant funded as well that is looking at cognitive enhancement therapy so that we can get people back to work and back to school, just as you were talking about. This is a time where it's really critical. They're trying to launch out of the home, and then it crash, you know.
Yes.
And so the savings that we can offer are you're not going to have somebody who's chronically ill. They have better outcomes. This is a well-established approach that is used in many areas of the world where it's actually been incorporated nationwide. And their suicide rate in this group is about 10%. So currently, we've been working for about 4 years. We've had no suicides. We've had a 95% retention rate. And I think if people look at how, you know, what the general retention rate is in psychiatric services, it's not even close to that. I mean, if you're really good, it might be 50 to 60%. So we're doing a phenomenal job with our small group. I really think it's an approach that can be used across. We start seeing people really frequently to establish a relationship, because that's really what guides the person through this time and accepting treatment and knowing that the treatment is correct, instead of saying, well, let's wait and see if they have another episode, because every time you're doing brain damage. And this is well known as also. So you have, you know, that functional decline each time. So I think that's our point, is that if you get in there early, you work with them intensively, you don't have the long term. And this has been studied in Australia for 25 years. And they can show a great benefit and a lowering of that functional decline. About 40% of our patients are working or back in school right now. So
these are, thank
Senator
you. These
Sharon.
This has been great testimony. You can see that the combination of components in this bill are related to intervention, early intervention. You've heard the testimony about, because with the drug formulary, using the right psychotic antidepressant antipsychotic at the right time, mm-hmm. early intervention, training persons in these scientifically based approaches that engage in treatment early in psychosis, because its repetition is what creates the chronicity and the more difficulty in the long term to deal with mental illness. And the School Link program offers a very much earlier intervention and increases what was described here as the compliance with the treatment program, which is also very important because of the access to the care in the school rather than having parents trying to leave work and move around. So that's the essence of the bill. I know that there were blanks in the bill in terms of what the proposed expenditure would be. Mr. Albrecht is willing to fill in the blanks for us this morning, and then whatever your wishes are at this time, Senator Lori.
We're doing 270, right?
Yes. So, Mr. Albrecht will tell us the numbers that Senator Sharon will move to fill in the blanks.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, and members, on line 2.16 in the blank there, insert $4,500,000. On line 2.22, insert $960,000. On line 2.30, insert $475,000. On line 3.4, insert $9,238,000. And on line 3.11, insert $473,000. On line 3.12, add the word "and" at the end of that line. And on 3.13, delete everything up to the word, the first two. So delete is for the commissioner and the blank.
Thank you. $9 million.
Okay. There's, as I add these up, Mr. Albrecht, there's still a balance left in the $10 million, it looks like, the 9.238 and the 473 don't add up to 10, but the balance would just be used for that. And is that
Why are you doing that?
I don't know. I was expecting to use the $10 million. I don't know.
It's money,
Dennis.
Yeah, I know. I see that.
It's great.
I pulled the numbers out of the fiscal note, Mr. Chair, and it looks to me like maybe I grabbed some wrong ones. We would fix it if this ends up in the bill.
We'll instruct.
Proportionately make it equal to $10 million.
We'll instruct. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm questioning why would you strike after so many dollars is for the commissioner and strike all the rest of the language to provide consultation to school districts that do not have school-linked mental health services grants and that want to collaborate with a community mental health provider. Why would you strike the balance of that language?
Is that Mr. Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, I didn't.
Right.
Senator Kiffmeyer,
it's just struck for the commissioner. So it's still to provide consultation.
BNC. Oh, it's the reverse. Okay.
Yes.
Striking
yes.
is for the commissioner and the dollars to provide.
Right.
Great. Good. Glad to hear it. It didn't make sense. I'm glad to hear.
So
Do we have a dollar amount in there, Mr. Chairman, then? Or is that all
going to be? No, the blank there was deleted. And so it's $473 for the two FTEs in the Children's Mental Health Division to manage the grants mm-hmm. and to provide consultation to the districts.
Okay.
So it's, it's still really under the commissioner. And we'll fix it and get up to the full allocation. Okay. It's probably the FFP that's the difference. But we will instruct staff to, make the adjustments necessary to make it work. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 3.6, again, just one of these things to have an understanding of the money. It says 25% of the new funding targeted to providers. So 25% of $9 million. Is that meant to – can you just explain the use of the $9.238 million?
Senator Sharon.
Seems like pretty low, 25%.
Do you want to speak to that? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, Sioux, after holding with NAMI Minnesota. So these are in addition to the base dollars that we currently have. And what we wanted is to target some of the new dollars for specific areas, including where we have high percentage of students who have an emotional behavioral disorder in that category in special ed, high poverty, because we know that comes along with a higher risk at risk of developing a mental illness, and then the high use of prone restraints, which for members who serve on the Education Committee know that there's a kind of an issue there in terms of schools using prone restraints. They need additional support to figure out what to do with that child so that they don't use it. And so we did agree as part of a task force through the Department of Education to target some of these dollars for that purpose.
Senator Laurie, I wondered, Senator Kiffmeyer, if you thought it was just the 25% of the total money was going to providers, but it isn't. It's 25% of the money going to providers is for a specific, it is sort of to lift up a special population.
To give a priority
to
these
priority. So all the money is will be used for provision of services, but it is targeting some of it towards a very specially high need population.
And it may be more than 25%.
Yes.
It's really giving a priority, making sure we don't fall below, that we don't forget this really high-need targeted group. Senator Kiffmeyer, a follow-up?
I think, Mr. Chairman and Senator Sharon, that does give me a better understanding. The root of my concerns is making sure that the entire state, when I see designations of populations and targeting of money, especially a large amount. I know that rural Minnesota and a variety of areas, so I just wanted to be sure that things were being spread around. And I think with the language anyway. But this is on top of how much money, Mr. Chairman? This is meant to be an additional amount of money? This is added to?
This is, there is a base for school-linked mental health.
It's 4.77.
That is 4.77, and this is an addition to that. And, this is also, I can't remember the governor's number, but he does the school-linked mental health grants as well. This is one we've talked about a lot. It's one of the really wise investments in making sure that we can identify in order to intervene and in order to treat, in order to provide a better life for individuals that otherwise have the story that Mr. Young described to us.
Senator Lori.
Senator Sharon.
I would just say, and to be responsive to the question, I think that our testifier was talking about the positive experiences that we've had in schools that have this existing.
Right.
So this is about acknowledging that the 4.77 base has been serving and has had good outcomes.
Absolutely.
And this is an expansion now to make this opportunity available at more school districts.
Right. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And two questions, actually, I have. I'm just reading on page 3, the $473,000 for two FDEs hired in the Children's Mental Health Division to manage the grants. Does that, can I understand
and,
that
and
to be?
And to provide consultation to the school districts. I mean, so it might be more than the, you know, there was a third function there. So, I mean, I don't think these are going to be $230,000 FTEs. I don't think that's the case, but Senator Sharon.
I need exactly. the job if
yeah.
that's the case.
Yeah, exactly.
Senator Sharon, to that question.
That's really, I'm sorry to be quipping, but you're absolutely correct, Senator Lori. It has a broader component than simply adding FTEs.
Because we combined those two functions into one, but it's a good question. Maybe you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But still, the FTEs will be receiving $235,000 for their job with those responsibilities in lines 13 to 15. Is that correct? I mean, that's I just need more clarification on that because I understand that to me, paragraph C explains what the FTEs will be doing for $473,000 for two of them. And to me, that looks like that's $235,000. And if that's what the mental health division averages for an employee, am I reading this wrong?
No, well, maybe I think Mr. Albrecht has. Apparently a bit of an explanation, and maybe we can call Mr. Hartford back up if he's could add some context. Mr. Albrecht?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, if you look at the fiscal note on page 270, and I have to be honest, I was just adding up these numbers as I was sitting here today because I ran out of time last night. So I might have numbers in the wrong place, but on page 5 of the fiscal note, under Section 3, Subdivision 4, you can see that there's detail there on salaries, costs for the positions here. So there's a mental health program consultant that's $96,000 a year, or in the first year, I should say. There's a mental health clinician in the second group there. There's a grant manager and a grant evaluator. And you can see there's a subtotal there. I think that is the total of those FTEs, and then that amount would be reduced by the 35% FFP there. That's what I was trying to get at. I may have picked up some of the wrong numbers there in that number that I actually said to insert.
So Mr. Chair.
But you'd have to. I was also adding for both years, so that's not an annual amount.
Right, that 473 is for the biennium.
Biennium, that's true. And it's four FTEs.
It's true.
So, I think what we were trying to get at again on page 5.
Mm-hmm, I got
of 8.
Mr. Chair, are you comfortable with the way that is reading then? Okay.
I think so. I mean, so if members want to, you could add the subtotal of administration there, 395 and 366, and subtract the FFP, 150 and 139, and I think you'd get somewhere close to the 473 that we're putting in there. And you can see that the salaries are, you know, the annual salaries are 57,000, 66,000. They're not overly exorbitant.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Chair, the other question?
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. The language on line 3.8, the commissioner must distribute grants to rural and urban counties, in that information above, too, on the highest percentage of special ed students in the EBD category, high poverty and high use of prone restraints. Does that language is that a disadvantage for those smaller school districts? As I think Senator Kiffmeyer was kind of getting at that too. Does that eliminate? Does that make them the loser in this? Because is this a percentage of their of the kids enrolled? You have to have a high prone restraint, a high high level of poverty, or is it just per district? So then you're going to have the winners in Duluth and St. Cloud and Mankato, and you won't have the winners in some of the smaller communities.
Are you asking, is it a raw number or a percentage?
I guess I'd like a little more clarification, because as I read this right now, the highest percentage of special ed students, well, the highest percentage, of course, is going to be in the school districts with the most children.
I read that, and I think the intent was the highest percentage of the population of that school district, and that I think that's the intent.
I would assume.
And if we need to clarify that, if there's ambiguity, and if you read ambiguity in it, maybe we can.
Mr. Chair, I would appreciate some clarification, because I believe that this was not the intent of the language. But to me, it seems like it will pick some winners and losers. Just because of the number of children, but you can have a small school district in Sartell or in Ceylon, and they have a high percentage of special ed children. So is that something we could work on going forward?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I read it as the percentage of the students. You know, we have X percent in our school district of high poverty or of the EBD. Children and we do actually.
Mm-hmm. I bet you do. Mm-hmm.
So, on that question, I wonder: measure for the high poverty? I mean, what do we use for that? Is that
exactly.
Is that free? I mean, because one of the troubles I often run into with high poverty is free and reduced lunch, and my community is an incredibly resilient community and resistant to asking for assistance. I mean, so it's like half of the level of poverty of the people eligible for free and reduced lunch actually sign up for it. And it's frustrating. And so sometimes the measures that we use aren't right. Does anybody, Senator Rosen?
Well, thanks. That's a good question, Mr. Chair. Are these measures appropriate in here? And that's, I guess, Ms. Abderholden, maybe you can... Does this need to be worked on that makes it fair for the entire...
Yeah, I think the special ed students are, it is what it is. I think that one would be pretty straightforward, would be my guess. But whenever I see high poverty, I often wonder, because when I look at a lot of the statistics from the Children's Defense Fund and then compare it to how the schools calculate poverty, which is typically off of free and reduced lunch, there's a huge difference, because other areas of the state somehow have a better ability to get people to sign up for some of the programs, and it's something that always perplexes me. The high use of prone restraints, I would think, would also be a pretty straightforward calculation. But Ms. Abderholden, maybe you could shed some light on the measurements suggested here and whether they really would target those that we're trying to get at. Are you comfortable with it? And
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, Senator Sharon and I just quick talked, and, if we need to take out the high poverty, that's fine, because the schools do use free and reduced lunch as a way to measure that. But I do think the EBD category is pretty straightforward, and the prone restraints is very, very straightforward. So we just wanted to try to make sure that some of those new dollars, a small percentage of it, would be targeted at those areas, because we do depend on the mental health centers and programs, applying for the grants, and then they work with the schools. So in a way, it's also a little bit of a direction to them to try to work with those particular schools. But, if high poverty is a problem, I think we can take that out.
Senator Sharon?
I want to go back to the 25% of the new funding and the concern about its distribution statewide. If this is of all of the funding, and if the it's directed to providers who have a special ability to deal with those unique characteristics, and so if that 25% all ends up in the urban area, then there still is this other requirement that the overall distribution has to be distributed fairly around the state. So I don't think that that creates this dissonance of imbalance between where the money is spent, because it's of the funding. It's not of each school district's funding. And also, I hesitate to take the poverty issues out, even though some may or may not apply for a free and reduced lunch. But I do think the poverty issue is important in the actual dynamic problem that the provider has to deal with in the sessions and with the family that they're dealing with. So it does create a higher level of complexity for consistency and follow-through in mental health treatment, not only for that individual client, but for that family.
Well, from my perspective, I wouldn't try to make you take the poverty level out of the bill. But I do oftentimes talk with our K-12 folks and try to encourage them to come up with some better measures, maybe, that might be more reliable on the poverty statistics. And if they were able to do that, those might flow nicely into here, because it is an important measure, but sometimes maybe not perfectly accurate. But I wouldn't try to make you take it out of here, because I do think that is important. But Senator Rosen, additional?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Abderholden, you know, of course, you know I love this program, but I'm still a little perplexed that how does a school district such as Janesville, that perhaps has a good special ed program, but of course it's a small school, how do they compete with the school district, say, in Mankato? How is it on a percentage basis of their total students? I don't think that question has been answered yet. That's what I'm trying to get at. Is this a fairness across the board, or are you just going by this of the funding?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen, the way that it works is it's actually the mental health provider who applies, not the school, because okay. It is the mental health provider who is then providing the clinical services, and then they collaborate with schools in their community. And I know in the last round of grants that every provider except one who applied got some money. Wasn't the amount that they needed or had requested, but they did get some, except for one, and they should have done a better job on their grant application. But so that's really how it works. So there is kind of equal footing, if you will, if the provider in your area, you know, applies and then works with that particular school district, then they'll be able to get those services. But we've had, as you know, limited funding in order to expand it.
And Senator Lurie.
Senator Sharon.
In our conversation about this in the policy committee, you probably remember this, but as you're talking, I remember when we looked at where is this money being distributed, and we could see the gaping hole in the southern part of the state. We were reminded it is the provider that applies for this to the department. They're the ones that receive the money. It's really not about the school district at all, except then that provider develops a relationship with the school district. So your question at that time was, how are we making certain that providers out there mm-hmm. are aware of this opportunity, and so that they make this application for, so our schools do have the opportunity there to have this SchoolLink program? And I think that is a critical question that we have to make sure happens with this program.
One of the things I'm taking from this conversation is I think we're all on the same page mm-hmm. of what we want from this, which right. is a very good thing. Maybe one of the questions that you had earlier, maybe council could tell us how this paragraph does read, whether the percentage applies, how that percentage applies. Is it, would it be the percentage within each school, and that 25% would be targeted towards those schools, even if they're smaller, with a large percentage of poverty or EBD kids or prone restraint usage, or would it be more of a number based?
Mr. Chair, it's the former.
So okay.
It states that the schools with the highest percentage of special education students, so within that school, it's how many special ed students are within that school, and it's that percentage. And then based on that, then they would be eligible. If there's a high percentage within that school, then they would be eligible for this, the 25% funding. But then there's, in addition, if they don't have a high percentage, there's the 75% that's left to distribute to those other schools. But yes, it is from the way I read it is it's within the school, the percentage in the school. Does that help?
Thank you. So I think we're getting closer, and we can continue to have conversations again, especially since we're all kind of on the same page with it. So any further questions of members? Senator Rosen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Charon, so remind me when I asked that question in your committee about that big void in southern Minnesota that's part of your district actually, is it because the mental health providers were not aware of the education, or that there's school districts that do not have a mental health provider available?
Senator Charon?
What we do know is that they did not apply. That my understanding is that they did not apply. The providers did not apply. Now, whether or not, why did they not apply? I don't know the answer to that question. You had suggested, and I thought was a reasonable question of whether or not how did we distribute the information about this opportunity? Do we need to do more about that? Was it because the providers went to schools and couldn't find schools that were interested in this? Maybe, but I can't imagine that would be the case. So or is it, as you said, that there aren't any providers out there that have, you know, the capacity to?
No.
I know that the children's mental health the expertise of children's mental health care is a scarce source. Mm-hmm. So that may be a contributing factor too. Yeah.
And Mr. Chair,
Senator Rosen.
That's where that $473,000 is going to go, to provide consultation to school districts that do not have school-linked mental health grants. So
yes.
There will be. Great.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Thank you. Good.
All right. Further questions of members? Seeing none, anybody else in the audience care to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 270? Seeing none, Senator Charon moves that Senate File 270, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Charon. We're going to take Senator Marty, I believe, is here now, and we're going to bring him up for Senate File 787. Welcome to the committee, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 787 is a very simple bill. Simply, I would argue, clarifies the definition of who qualifies for case management under the Adult Mental Health Act. Right now, qualified if an adult has a diagnosis of schizophrenia, bipolar, major depression, or borderline personality disorder. And we want to add schizoaffective disorder, which is sort of a blurring of different combination of schizophrenia and affective disorder. And since we already cover both of those, I think most folks, they're supposed to be covered. They are generally covered, but I could have my witnesses clarify the problems with it.
All right. Ms. Stark, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a clinical psychologist and chair of the Psychological Association's Legislative Committee. About 1 in 100 individuals experience symptoms of schizoaffective disorder, and each individual presents with unique symptom picture. And both the nature and intensity of symptoms change over time, with periods of greater severity interspersed with better functioning. It's a complex illness to manage due to the range of symptoms. It includes symptoms usually associated with schizophrenia, such as difficulties in thinking, disorganized speech, delusions, and hallucinations. And in addition to these symptoms, the individual also must cope with severe difficulties with mood, such as changes in appetite and energy, hopelessness, helplessness, suicidal thinking, sleep problems, problems with concentration, and expansive, irritable, and depressed mood. The psychotic symptoms and the mood symptoms may occur at the same time, but they may occur at different times. And the changeability of symptoms makes predicting the kinds and levels of services needed difficult to assess for the average person. And having ready access to case management and other services is crucial to treat symptoms as they evolve. including schizoaffective disorder in the definition of major mental illness, will allow the necessary services for patients to maintain stability and allow for their changing needs. It's an awkward position for a professional to be forced to lie about a diagnosis to ensure that they can, their patients can get appropriate care. A diagnosis is a tool for communication about the symptoms and needs of an individual. Currently, to get services, professionals have to diagnose schizoaffective disorder or a mood disorder. And doing this interferes with vital communication about the entirety of an individual's needs. And it means that significant and disabling symptoms may fail to be identified and treated. And having to game the system is problematic in a lot of ways. And professionals risk their integrity and their license, but most importantly, the patient's needs are not effectively met. By way of an example, I was referred an individual with schizoaffective disorder that lost her job and her insurance coverage. She had a long history of symptoms and hospitalizations, but also worked and supported herself at times. At the age of 60, to be forced into a situation of looking for employment was a significant stressor. While her psychiatrist saw her for a reduced rate, assisted her in getting medications for a low cost, and I was able to get her some vocational services, she needed and deserved more. And because services were not available, she was forced to deal with dizzying systems without much support and had to make choices that will compromise the rest of her life. She deserved better. So I'd urge you to include schizoaffective disorder in statute as the major mental illness it is, so that patients can receive the complete and timely care they need and deserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stark. Mr. Burkett, did you have additional comments to add? Maybe they could be brief. This doesn't have any fiscal.
They will be brief, Chairman Laurie.
Thank you.
Hearing health and services.
Can you pull the microphone close?
You can't
there
hear
me. There we
go. He's a perfect example of the wisdom of using that category. Marlon was morbidly obese, suffered from high blood pressure, severe back problems, diabetes, serious sleep apnea, and other physical ailments. He was seeing doctors between 9 and 12 times a month, taking 13 different prescription meds, hospital room, frequent flyer, was admitted numerous times through the year, and he was really needing the case management services, which he talked about last week. And as a result of getting the case management services, he really turned his life around. I won't go into the details of that, but his case isn't unique. Dr. Stark talked about another case. We've served at People Incorporated 900 clients in case management this last year in many different counties, and the subgroup of those clients have both a problem with the cognitive slippage of schizophrenia and the mood disorders of bipolar. So they're worse off often than people with just bipolar or just schizophrenia, and that's why we say schizoaffective, because we're combining. We're saying they have the symptoms of both. So it's just very important that we not leave these folks out of the milieu. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Burkett. Senator Benson.
And Mr. Chair, I owe Senator Marty an apology. We heard this in policy, and we're just going to pass it to the floor. And I raised my hand and said, is there any fiscal implications? And that is why he's here. It's a zero fiscal note. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Well, and actually, we're going to dual track it. The House, the other body, isn't able to get it to the floor at this point based on their rules. It's going to likely be in their omnibus bill. We think that they ought to be able to pass bills to the floor. So we're going to dual track this. We're going to send it along on its way in case the House rethinks their ability to send bills like this with no fiscal effect along their way. And then, but we're going to leave it on the table here as well, so that if they don't rethink that, we'll be able to include it in our omnibus. So any further comments, Senator Marty?
No, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the committee's support.
You're welcome. Anyone else in the audience care to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 787? Seeing none, Senator Benson moves that Senate File 787 be dual-tracked, that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance, and that it be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Marty.
Thank you.
I think, Senator Eakin, would you like to just take up your bill and get that? No testifiers, you promised.
Right.
We're just going to take that amendment that you didn't have last night and get that done. Senate File 1074.
Yes. Senate File 1074, again, this was the bill that was already heard last night and testimony. Screening, the additional $10 fee that would be applied to the programs for the deaf and the hard of hearing. And it was an amendment to incorporate the figures fiscal note into the bill to plug in the numbers. Also, the amendment also does make it clear that this program is voluntary. People aren't required to be in it. It's something that parents can voluntarily participate in, and that is the A3 amendment to the bill.
Senator Eakin moves the A3 amendment. There's still blanks on it, though.
We're deleting the blanks.
Delete the blanks. I see it. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm like reading wrong. I'm getting tired. Senator Eakin moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Now we have 1074 fixed up. The blanks are gone. And we have the fiscal note in front of us. We had, you know, a good hearing on it last night. Senator Eakin moves Senate File 1074 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Eakin. Senator Sharon, you ready with your next ones?
Sorry, I should have told you I was
going to do that. 598, Senator Sharon? Is that?
Thank you, members. I am here with Senate File 598. This bill was reviewed in policy and is here in order to make certain that the fiscal issues are resolved. If you note from the fiscal note that there is not to the state a fiscal implication, there is a $25,000 cost to the legislation, which will pay for a 0.3 FTE, but the costs are covered by a federal grant, so there's no cost to the states at this time. What it is a bill that addresses and improves the process by which we designate facilities for their capacity to be responsive to stroke. Stroke, of course, is something like many other issues. The more rapidly we can intervene, the more we are able to interfere with the progression of the disease and the destruction of the disease. So unless there is an interest in discussing the contents or the purpose of the bill further, it's fairly straightforward. I would simply say that in the course of our hearings, there were some questions about the term joint commission, and therefore I do have an amendment that was worked on with Senator Marty, who raised the question, and he has agreed to this language, and so I'd like to offer it to improve the basic bill. It's the okay. A1 amendment.
That's being handed out right now, okay?
Right, and it's simply a clarification of a definition. It has no impact on the fiscal note.
Okay. And Mr. Albrecht, we have the fiscal note drafted to the House version of the bill here. It does show a zero fiscal note, as Senator Sharon testified. It hasn't been handed out to members. We can have it copied if members want, or Mr. Albrecht can confirm. But I think more trees could live if we just trusted him.
And, got it.
Senator Sharon moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 598. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So this is another bill with no fiscal implication that, as far as the Senate's concerned, could travel on its own. But in the other body, it is quite possibly stuck in a manner in which it would need to be included in their omnibus bill. So we're going to do that same dual track. Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 598, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance, and that it be on the table for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill in the Senate. So on that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sharon. Are you ready for Senate File 265?
Yes. And I would invite Jenny Bennett to the table.
Ms. Bennett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is in regard to Senate File 265. Thank you, Senator Laurie. Let me see. Would you like to talk a little bit about what's in the bill? Is that what your plan is? Just here for questions. Okay.
Do you want to go through the bill?
I can.
All right. Thank you very much, members. This is a bill also that has been reviewed by the Policy Committee and supported for your consideration for funding. It requires the Commissioner of Human Services in consultation with others to develop recommendations and any necessary legislation related to a state-operated child and adolescent behavioral health services facility. And in the process, ensure that the facility provided and services that are provided within that facility meet the needs of children with serious and emotional disturbances, autism, reactive attachment disorder, a variety of childhood mental illness issues. And it also is to assure that qualified personnel and staff can be recruited who have that very special expertise to treat children in the facility, and that the treatment is of high quality, scientifically based, and effective. And then also within the bill, under Section 2, the subdivisions relate to children's mental health crisis services. These are to expand those to additional county services that exist in some counties and tribes to provide training on mental illness in children for the family, from the family's perspective, and resources for the children with mental illnesses teams to utilize in serving children in the state. And Subdivision 2, mental health first aid training. This is a fabulous concept. I love the term. It appropriates about $45,000 to the commissioner to train teachers and social service personnel and law enforcement and others who will be coming in contact with children with mental illnesses. Children and adolescents mental health first aid training will help them begin to identify more quickly what it is they're dealing with rather than simply thinking children are being bad. And then in Subdivision 3 is a respite care component, which allows families to have some relief when they have their families dealing with a family member with very serious emotional disturbances that are hard to manage and maintain a stable treatment for. In Subdivision 4 is the community health worker training program. And that's, in essence, what is in this bill. There is a fiscal note, and Jenny Bennett is here to answer any of your tough questions.
And to share a little bit of her story. Everyone else did yesterday.
Oh, okay. And to tell a little bit of her story. So I will turn the microphone over to Jenny.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me share my story today.
My son Jack is 11 years old, and I speak about him with his permission. By the age of 8, he was diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder, a mood disorder which is believed to be bipolar, ADHD, anxiety, depression, oppositional defiance disorder, and sensory integration disorder. He's recently spent time inpatient at Fairview Riverside Pediatric Psychiatric Unit. From the age of 4, most of our days contained several tantrums or outbursts, and they last several hours. There's frequent damage to our home, injuries to our family members, and our life is held hostage to his mood swings. Managing his education, even with a great team, has been a huge challenge. And in May of 2012, after an incident in her classroom, his teacher, who is a seasoned special education teacher of 20 years, described the incident as the scariest experience of her entire teaching career. Later the same night, he took his blanket and his favorite bear out into the dark, and he lay in the road and waited for a car to squash him. Having recently become a youth mental health first aid teacher, I really wish these skills had been available to me and those involved in Jack's life much earlier. I can't even begin to explain the isolation of not being able to do the normal things that you will do with a child that you expect because of how their symptoms are perceived by the community. Sports and daycare, summer camps, church events, and even school activities were just not possible or ended really badly. Providing basic mental health first aid to individuals who come into contact with children and teens would change the lives of so many families that live this way and could significantly reduce the rising suicide rates among youth by early recognition of the signs and the ability to actually do something about it. The county that I live in has had an alarming number of completed suicides in teens in the last year, and there were many, many more attempts, including that of my own child. Suicide is the third leading cause of death in this age group. Suicide is preventable. All it takes is basic mental health first aid training for those who are in contact with kids to actually save lives. In my work, I provide peer support to many families like mine, in addition to leading support groups and to dealing with the calls and the emails to NAMI's parent line. So many of the families are really struggling to provide adequate mental health care for their children for many reasons. There's a huge percentage of working families. Taking a child to many of the psychiatrists, psychologists, and therapists and medical appointments that's involved in this kind of family is a huge burden, and many people don't have the kind of job that allows them the flexibility they'll permit that. Many kids are uninsured or underinsured, especially those in low-income families or minority communities. And increasing the availability of school-linked mental health would greatly alleviate these problems and improve the early identification of mental illnesses in kids. Early intervention gives them the best chance to complete their education, the best chance not to enter the criminal justice system, and the best chance to become a healthy, functioning member of the community. I also urge you to support increased funding for respite care. Caregiver stress is proven to be extremely high in families with children of special needs, especially so when a child has a mental illness. Parenting should not involve being bitten, punched, kicked, pushed downstairs, and verbally abused relentlessly. Parenting should not result in parent developing depression or anxiety disorders, and in some cases, PTSD simply from raising a child. But when it does, being able to access respite for their child, to know that they are safe while they recuperate mentally and physically, and access community resources to help themselves and their child is crucial. Unaddressed, this issue leads to more significant health care costs as parents themselves face crisis that could have been avoided if access to respite was available sooner. With respite care, exhausted parents can withstand much more and delay or even prevent hospitalizations, which are the most costly part of our system. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my story.
And thank you. That was fabulous. And I can tell you that listening to the story about what the experience is for parents and the importance of respite care, when you work in a facility that deals with very difficult to manage psychiatric disorders, we work very hard to make certain that that staff doesn't work long hours because of the very issue that this parent is talking about, that dealing with that constant kind of challenge to a person for boundary setting or for managing acting out behavior and staying calm and being able to help soothe or reduce anxiety in a child is exhausting. So we make certain that staff is not on call for long periods of time. So, it's not unreasonable to try to find a way to give families an opportunity to get some relief from that, not only for the parents, but for the siblings that are in the home, also seeing their parents' attention and energy directed elsewhere. So thank you for talking about that. With that, we're prepared to talk with you about what it would take from you as a committee in order for us to achieve some of these objectives.
Filling in the blanks, that is, Senator Sharon?
We have some blanks to fill in.
All right. Is Mr. Albrecht going to step us through that, or are you?
I will.
Okay, Mr. Albrecht. I won't try to add them this time. I'll just...
Mr. Chair, this time I'm... This one's even worse than the previous one, to be honest with you.
So maybe you should.
I guess for members, this is probably way deeper into my life than you care to go. On line 2.4, in the blank there, insert $3,500,000. And on line 2.15, insert $1,026,000. Now I'm going to ask you to turn to page 4 of the fiscal note. And at the top, excuse me, of that page is an analysis of Section 2, which is not currently included in the appropriations section of this bill. This Section 2 directs them to develop standards for facility licensure. So in addition to the appropriations that are in the bill, it needs another one of $291,000 for licensure in Section 2.
So, Mr. Albrecht, we'd need a Subdivision 5 with another appropriation subdivision? Is that...
Mr. Chair, I would defer to the council on how best to accomplish incorporating that.
The department's already doing this. I don't know why they need $300,000. I mean, you might want to.
Just a variation.
Yeah, for the standards.
Okay. Ms. White?
Mr. Chair and members, I can add another subdivision reflecting the appropriation for purposes of Section 2.
And so for members, what we'd do is move the oral amendment, $3.5 million on line 2.4, $1,026,000 on line 2.15, and instruct staff to devise a subdivision 5 accommodating the $291,000 for licensure as spelled out in subdivision or section 2 rather. Members understand the motion before us?
Yeah.
Kathy, does that meet with your Senator Sharon? Does that meet with your?
Yes, is the amendment, but also did we include the $15,000 for Subdivision 4 in that amendment?
Well, there's no amendment needed for that.
That's
already
in
there.
Thank you.
Yep.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Albrecht.
I see Senator Benson looking at the numbers on this fiscal note, and so I would again ask members to go to page 4.
Mm-hmm.
And this fiscal note is not prepared to match the language in this bill because these appropriations are all for the biennium. So in fiscal year 2014, on the line that says children's mental health grants that currently says 4556. I believe that number is supposed to be 4586. Somehow $30,000 got lost here.
In each of the 4 years?
No. And then in 2015, there should be nothing in there. That number shouldn't be there. And probably the same thing should be the case in 2016. That number should be adjusted, and then the number in 2017 shouldn't be there.
Well,
substantially less.
In reality, we would probably appropriate these amounts so that they carry forward correctly. So we would probably change this language to be annual appropriations within the biennium. But I'm just pointing out that the total is supposed to be what's really reflected on the bottom line, which would become $47,36 in 2014 and $141,000. That's the biennial total for 2014 and 15. I apologize for all of that talking to explain it.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Albrecht, I was trying to avoid going too deeply into the
Senator Thompson. Does that make sense? I mean, I think I tracked it. I got it written down here and understand that the 3.5, the 1.026, and the 291 do add up to what Mr. Albrecht described. So, I mean, if members are comfortable, we can go ahead and move that. Senator Sharon moves that amendment as described. All those in favor of that signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So then on the bill, Senator Sharon moves Senate File 265 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Senator Sharon. Okay. Yep. Senator Hayden is not with us yet. He's got the only two other standalone bills on the agenda today. We'll move to the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill. Senate File 1034 will be going over the school linked grants, the clinical care coordination benefit, the family psychoeducation benefit, mental health crisis response services, adult rehab, mental health payment rate, mental health specialty treatment services, mental health transition services, transition initiatives for populations, and mental health treatment permitted in foster care. And I'm going to come up to the table. There's mine. And there is a one-page handout for members from the Department of Human Services as we work through this. Chair, thank you. So we're taking up Senate File 1034 again, as described, and so I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Hartford to step us through the sections of the bill just described.
Well, this morning,
Mr. Hartford.
Madam Chair, Senators, again, Dave Hartford, Assistant Commissioner, Chemical and Mental Health Services. I will be using, I believe everyone has a copy, to just help guide two budget pages as I move through these bills. Before I get started, I just want to state a couple of things about this body of work as a whole, and that's to recognize that there's still significant unmet needs across the populations that these bills address. So as we went through really carefully taking a look at the needs across the system, and I would really put all of these proposals into one of three categories. One would be just system improvements.
Mr. Hartford, before you continue, can you just show us what you're working off of?
I'm just speaking at
you're
this
point. You're
just
speaking, but what
yeah,
will you
document,
be
working on? This document, I haven't gotten to the first, we'll be dealing off of budget page 75 and talking about establishing a clinical care coordination benefit.
Mr. Hartford, is that in our blue book, or is that just in the budget pages?
Budget pages.
That's
a
budget
page.
Thank you.
75. Excuse me.
Budget pages, yeah. Okay. Members, it is the blue book then.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Hartford.
We'll get organized here. Thank you. Proceed.
That's it?
And, Madam Chair?
Senator Lori?
On the DHS one page, the last item there, eliminate alternative to Moose Lake grant. We're not going to cover that today. The Hospital Association had wanted to be here for that, and the folks they wanted to do that aren't able to be here today, and we had assured them that we would not cover that. We'll plan on covering that on the day that we do state-operated services. Is what we had agreed to. So we'll go over the rest of the items on that one pager, just to, you know, try to maintain the last. On the DHS, you'll find the DHS one pager that was just recently handed out of the items that we're going to cover today. And the very last item.
That was not handed out yet. That's what the
problem. That's not handed out. Oh, okay. Well, then when it is handed out, the budget page 87. Eliminate the alternative to Moose Lake grant, which will be the last item on that page, will not be covered today.
Thank you, Senator Lori. We are just getting ourselves organized here because some have it, and I don't think
here. Madam Chair, one more item of housekeeping. When Senator Hayden is able to make it to us today, he's only going to be able to be here for a little bit of time, so we're going to lay this on the table wherever we're at, maybe, you know, finish a sentence or two, and allow Senator Hayden to present the two bills that he has remaining on the agenda, and then return wherever we're at in that, just for housekeeping.
Great. Thank you, Senator Lurie. Perfect. Mr. Hartford?
Madam Chair? Again, as I was stating, that a great deal of work went into really assessing the system as a whole, and all of these bills really fall into what I would say one of three categories. Either system improvements, language existing that we're really tweaking and repurposing and trying to get the most value that we can out of the system today. Another category would be what I would say investment, where we're really carefully investing new dollars to get the best return of value. And then the last category is just savings, what savings can be found within our system, and again, with a recognition that there are many unmet needs within this population. So with that, I'll start, and again, budget page 75, establish a clinical care coordination benefit in medical assistance. The concept here is to have our professionals, our clinicians, be able to be reimbursed for the time that it takes to consult with other organizations, other care providers, so that the treatment plan that is developed can be translated and coordinated. Currently, there's no funding that exists for that consultation and care coordination. We propose funding that by repurposing targeted case management grant and creating this new benefit in medical assistance for this consultation and coordination. This would be $4.2 million used for our MA match, and an additional $700,000 would be taken in savings. These are both biennium numbers.
Questions from the committee?
Yes.
Senator Sharon?
Just a quick question. Can you tell me what this on the tracking on page 75 under recommendation line 3, it says $2.15 million in children's mental health grants to counties that funds services through the local county administered system. Does that exclude some counties? What counties would not be included in the benefit of this?
Mr. Hartford?
Sorry.
Madam Chair, Senator, it does cover all counties.
Okay. Any further questions? Mr. Harker.
Okay, the next item is to establish a psychoeducation benefit and medical assistance, budget page 77. Again, this is a repurposing concept where in lieu of an individual psychotherapy session that a provider may have with a child, this would permit funding for that therapist to spend time or provider to spend time with the family, translating that treatment plan, educating the family to really be incorporated in the care of that child, to really leverage the family's ability to appropriately intervene, move the treatment plan, and it leverages our system. And this would just be paid. It's a zero cost. It's a repurposing of the existing individual therapy dollars and just would create that new benefit.
Any questions from the committee? Yeah, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Hartford. It looks like this is contingent upon federal approval.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes.
Mr. Hartford.
And could you please explain? So it sounds like it's a shifting. So it's just a matter of this money will go back into children's mental health. There's not going to be a cut in resources if we don't get federal approval. I just want to make sure I'm understanding more and more federal approval.
Mr. Hartford.
Madam Chair, Senator, it is it's part of our Medicaid, since it's a new medical assistance benefit, it needs approval federally to approve that benefit. It doesn't create other changes or it doesn't have those implications. It's just approval for that MA benefit.
Okay, thank you. And
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Hartford, as we go forward, and particularly as we get into next week, if there are things contingent on federal approval, I'd do my best to keep up. But if we could mention those so we can start tracking how much we're waiting for, it would be helpful. Thank you.
Senator Sharon. Just to follow up, this, my understanding would be that if you're working with a child that has mental health issues, that what this allows is the provider to treat the family in the idea that in treating the family, it has its capacity to treat the child. So this is a proven approach that we've eliminated supportive dollars for. So you end up only focusing on the patient. And when it's a child, it's obvious that oftentimes what we're seeing in the mental health situation is an outcome of unresolved issues in the family system. So this will create the potential for a clinician to do what they know they need to do and get reimbursed for it in the treatment of a child. It's saying you can be reimbursed for that service when you're treating a child, correct?
Mr. Hartford?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, that's correct.
And you're not really anticipating a fiscal impact.
And it's in lieu of an individual session
that's
with
right.
a child.
That's right. That's important. Super. Any further questions? Mr. Hartford.
Then I will move to the third item on budget page 81, adjustment of adult rehabilitative mental health services payment rate and provision of services, commonly known as the ARMS rate. Again, the ARMS services established in 2006 are really a foundational mental health service to help people with serious mental illness manage their symptoms. It's a variety of different services that are available. The rates have not changed since these were established, and we have not added to, again, reference to our state plan. This would also call for approval because we're looking to have additional services, if you will, within that package. We know because of this rate issue that many providers have been, were not reimbursing for the cost of these services. We've lost approximately 10% of our providers doing ARMS. We're also, many of our providers have stopped doing some of these services, providing some at under cost because they're essential and cutting other ones. So this is about two things. One, restructuring the payments so that it's a break-even proposition, The second piece of it is to add additional services that weren't included in the initial package, things like transportation, clinical supervision, some of the other pieces that make these services work as a whole. In order to fund this, these changes, we look to the Mental Health Integrated Fund to provide the MA match of $6 million. It's anticipated between MA expansion and federal match, the state grants, we will be able to apply $16 million to this change in the armed services in order to fund the changes. I think to recognize in those changes, the counties will need to reassess how the integrated fund grants are used. That's done on an annual basis, that they'll need to readjust how their funds with that reduced amount to the integrated fund as a whole, how they will repurpose and use their flexible funds in the following years.
Mr. Hartford, on page 82 on the budget tracking, the adult mental health grants look like they're being cut. Is that is that what's going to feed the other grants going forward? If you look at the budget tracking,
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And so, by cutting those grants, Mr. Hartford, will they be able to provide the same services? Are the
currently the grants are flexible in that counties establish needs in a community, and those are flexible dollars that are provided to communities to meet unmet needs. This repurposing will commit dollars to the armed services, but then the counties, again, it's reassessed every year. How do you use and work around if those changes took place within the armed services? How would the rest of the service array within the county need to be refigured?
Okay. And this recommendation came from the advisory group, the Mental Health Reform Steering Advisory Committee?
Yes.
This is the
Chair,
way to fund this,
yes,
to make it budget neutral. Okay. Thank you. Senator Sherrod?
An important piece of this is that by transferring these funds from the grant piece that we do now that doesn't generate federal funds into the Medicaid program, it generates significant federal funds to support the increased rates for and utilization for the arms providers. So it's
Sarah Sharon.
But in the process, Senator Lori, we're able to draw down the federal dollars, but is the money then directed to a different group so that then the counties are going to have to experience the reduction in order for this money to be gained and transferred to another group? Mr. Hartford?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, yes, there is $6 million from the integrated fund that will become $16 million total spent in the communities. So with that, these are specific services targeted the same populations. So there are additional dollars going to the community around these so that counties will have to adjust to that reduction and reconsider how they're spending those flexible state-only dollars.
I just want to make sure I understand that. But have they participated in this and they agree that this is an adjustment that they support, the counties?
Mr. Hartford? Are they part of the advisory committee? Do they have members on the advisory committee?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I would say that this is one there's not consensus around that, is the way I would answer your question there.
Senator
Senator Sharon.
Because there's a value of flexibility versus flexibility. It's good to have flexibility. It's also establishing Medicaid benefits that serve the same population is an important feature, because without this foundational service, then we're going to not serve. They're going to need even more flexible services in the community. So it's kind of a balancing. And again, this is really around how do we, as a department, looked at this, how do we provide funding for these expansion of services?
I understand that. I just need to understand accumulatively what we're doing to meet the state's needs at the expense of the counties. The counties continue to have an obligation that they have less money to respond to, or is that obligation met through a different program? And if it's not, then I just think we should be absolutely transparent about that. Mm-hmm. And you know, there always is a conflict over where to spend money. But the implications of it are that there's less money for flexible spending at the county level. I need to know that clearly, because when I vote for something, I will be hearing about this from my counties if they haven't participated. And it's an accumulative set of obligations that we add to their property taxes.
And Mr. Hartford, are we doing the same thing with the children's mental health grants, eliminating those but then drawing down the
Madam
Medicaid?
Madam Chair, no, we're not.
That's a different...
This is just on the adult. This is just one funding mechanism to fund these armed services. And again, I think that there's a next step with reduced fund, because this does ultimately give you a reduced funding level to the counties in the integrated fund, which means that there would need to be additional planning work and a next step as to how best to meet those needs in a local community. Because we have a moving, and again, back to a moving landscape here of, as we're trying to adjust, recognizing many of these integrated fund dollars were identified for uninsured individuals. These were flexible funds to meet the needs. And as we look at what's going to be the impact of ACA, what's going to be the impact to these different programs, the need for overall need of integrated fund dollars should be decreasing over time, because there are more people going to have coverage. There's changes in our funding mechanisms around this population. So we're really, that's part of that ongoing, really looking over the next few years. We've got all of this work happening around the exchange and many things like that. But the rest of the landscape is really following some of these changes, and that's some of this work that's going on here and looking at this adjustment to ARMS. We know we need to make this adjustment to ARMS to keep this foundational service going. What will it look like in the future? How do we get this funded? So there is ongoing work. I mean, it's recognized the counties and others will have to do ongoing work around meeting community needs as ACA, as healthcare reform evolves.
Madam Chair,
Senator Lori,
we've been having some discussions behind us as well here, and you know the county representatives here aren't ready to testify on this today. It hasn't been flagged to them yet as a concern. That's not to say that there isn't any concern among counties. They're going to get back to us on it, and we'll continue to work on it. But the intent of this really is to take over some of the work for the populations with mental illness that is currently done through the flexible county dollars and transfer some of those services with enhanced funding to the state Medicaid program. And so that really is the intent. And we do have Ron Brandt here, who would have some insight into the trade-off that we're talking about here, and would like to share that with the members if we could.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Senator Lurie. I like to understand the
Absolutely.
Trade-off before I'm voting for something. You know, sometimes I think sometimes the trade-off isn't very good, and I still vote for it, but at least I like to be responsible about the messes I'm making.
Now, Mr. Brandt.
Madam Chair, please. Members of the committee, my name is Ron Brandt. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, and our members provide a good deal of the armed services in the states, and they also work very closely with counties for the counties to as contractors or as a county program to help implement the services that the counties have prioritized as part of the Mental Health Act. And so we are, you know, we've been very involved in this work group and in the deliberations about the options here. And it's a painful sort of Sophie's choice that involves some trade-offs. But I want you to understand some of the analysis that went into this so that you can see how it was thought about. On one hand, let's start out with there are many unmet needs for this population, just to start out with. And so taking money away for this in order to add to something else, it doesn't mean that there would be something else that would emerge really quickly, housing or other medications for somebody who's uninsured. I mean, there could be a zillion other things that could come up. So that flexible funding has a great value because it can plug the holes for many, many different things that could never be reimbursed, let's say, by a robust health insurance program under ACA. It could be a drop-in center where people get some comfort and support and redirection for their accessing health care or other things. But that's not going to get paid for through the ACA. So recognizing that, what was done is there was an analysis of the current expenditures within the mental health grants and some thought about a portion of those funds are now being used for people who are uninsured, but who under the Medicaid expansion or Minnesota Care would become eligible for the ARMS benefit. So they were receiving ARMS-like services paid through the grant, but now as we expand Medicaid and Minnesota Care, that would be covered as part of their insurance package. And so that percentage arguably could be, this could help fund the expansion group. That's one variable. The other thing is that there are activities, service activities, that the ARMS providers currently do, whether it be travel or clinical supervision, consultation, some of the benefits that we had talked about with the children's program just a bit ago, where they're not currently covered by our Medicaid plan, but with some expansion and redefining of things, could be made to be allowable, reimbursable activities, but they're now being paid for by the grant. But if we changed our state plan to cover those things, then those also would be able to draw down federal dollars and fulfill a similar purpose. Does that make sense? So then, in the end, there's still huge unmet needs at the county level for things that are not able to be covered, but by targeting very specific functions that could be covering the expansion group or an expansion of the range of services, then we think that, or the rate increase, that we think that that would make this a more viable program for the whole population, because these are, it's really the same population of individuals oftentimes. Is that too much detail?
Yes. No, not at all. I just would like to be clear. I hope the counties will tell us as they analyze this what its implications are. It doesn't mean I won't vote for it, but I want to know what I'm going to get beaten up for when I go home.
Yes.
And the other thing is this does this movement of money over into the ARMS program and the services that you might be able to do over there that are now under the flexible dollars of the county, is that require approval at the federal level? And if it does, will the money remain in the state in the flexible grant program until we're assured that those services that are assumed to be covered under this new appropriation are in fact covered? Or are we going to cut the grants and then just sort of hope that approvals come for this to occur in the other program?
Madam Chair, Senator Chair, that's certainly the intention, is these stay in place, because this does require federal approval that these grants, that would be the purpose.
So, Mr. Harper, but still the same, my question about the clinical care coordination benefit and cutting the child mental health grants by $2.146 million, it's the same philosophy. You're drawing down the Medicaid dollars, but it is going to be, I shouldn't say it, a hit to the counties, but it is the dollars that are going to the county, and you'll be able to apparently draw, there is a little bit of a
Oh, it's actually going to be a cost, isn't it?
Again, that's correct, Madam Chair. That's correct. That it's a significant impact as we take a look at these flexible dollars, as Mr. Brand was saying, taking services that can be applied and made to into a Medicaid benefit. In this particular case, the state-only dollars, with the expansion population, it draws down our $6 million Minnesota dollars, becomes $16 million for services in the communities. So I think this is one avenue, is taking a look at what services can be made into a Medicaid benefit in order to draw down, to leverage this new environment. At the same time, if we're, that those services are taking, in fact, ARMS as a whole, since 2006, have been providing new services that used to be integrated fund dollars. The counties used to do these services. We've been doing this in 2006, so there's been a transfer, some transfer of effort, if you will. Not to say that these flexible dollars aren't important, but as we look at how many of them, and as we put more Medicaid benefits in place in a community, what is the need for those flexible dollars changes.
Senator Sheridan? I just want to emphasize that I understand the concept that we're trying to achieve more federal dollars drawdown and find ways to do that. We're doing that all through this budget in order to try to find a way to pay for the services people need. But the flexible dollars at the county level, that may be a place where I have a lot of difficulty because of the very description that you gave about how it's utilized. It's for those places that we do not have a silo to shove somebody into, and it allows people to get services instead of simply be abandoned because we don't have a program for them. So I'd be very careful about what we're doing here.
Yes, and once they're gone, they're gone. I mean, that's the fear, yes.
And Madam Chair, Senator Sheridan, the caveat that I started this with was just that concern, recognizing there continues to be unmet needs across all of these populations. So so as we take a look at these, trying to balance how do we progress forward, leverage, and be as wise as we can with the dollars that we have.
If I could make one other, Madam Chair.
Mr. Brandt.
If I could make another comment. The current path we are on, meaning if we've continued as we are without making some changes to the ARMS reimbursement rate or the range of services that it covers, we have already had providers who have dropped out entirely or have cut way back on their providing that service. And without some change in this, we risk having that whole program begin to deteriorate and not be available like it should be for the expanded population that we will be covering under Medicaid and Minnesota Care going forward. So this program itself is quite at risk without some change. This happens to be a cost-neutral way of paying for some improvements, but doing nothing, it will erode and continue to erode.
We don't have to go on about this. I think that we all are talking about the same thing. This is where the issue is not about what the goals are, but the fact that that the funding source to achieve this objective is one that I wish we didn't have to tap. And if it's a property tax relief capacity, it's going to be a property tax increase. If the adjustment that the counties have to make is about finding money to fill the gap, then maybe we ought to be looking at tax relief for counties in order to achieve this objective rather than the method that we're using here, hire aides to counties or some sort of movement into the tax committee that they ought to be doing something as a property tax relief component related to the demands on counties for mental health services.
Mm-hmm. Any further comments, questions? Mr. Hartford and Senator Lori, would it be okay to, are you ready to move on to the next?
I think so, except that I would, as indicated earlier, move. I would just lay Senate File 1034 on the table for a little bit here and allow Senator Hayden to present his couple of bills. Senator Hayden, you're going to have, I'm just going to leave my stack here. I'm tired of carrying it around.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden. And
Madam Chair,
Senator,
before we get going, pizza is on its way. It should be here in about 20 minutes, and I'm hungry, so.
Senator Lori, is it pizza? Is it gluten-free?
One is gluten-free, so it's going to be the small one that doesn't taste as good as the others, so just
with your name
leave
it
for me, and I'll be.
Well, now we will.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're doing just a little bit of work on one of the bills, but I think we want to move 1342.
Senator Hayden's Senate File 1342.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes.
Thank you.
1342 is a legislation that increases community health centers appropriation from the Minnesota Department of Health from $2.3 million to $6 million a year. Health centers, also known as FQHCs, serve 185,000 low-income Minnesotans throughout the state on an annual basis, which about 40% of those have been traditionally uninsured. They are located in inner city neighborhoods along the Twin Cities, along with locations in greater Minnesota. These community governed nonprofits provide primary medical, dental, behavioral health all under one roof. The funds appropriated in this bill would be used to continue, expand, improve services to low income populations. The Minnesota CHCs are key to reducing the glaring health disparities that exist in our state and also strive to prevent unnecessary emergency room visits and hospitalizations. The health centers use the existing funds for a wider range of uses, all targeted to improve health of the communities they serve. Increasing funding to health centers will further enable them to increase access to preventative services and therefore reduce the cost of care for uninsured patients and medical assistance patients as well. With me today is the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Community Health Directors, Rhonda
Degalo.
Ms. Degalo will further outline why this is a wise investment in Minnesota's safety net.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Ms. Degalo, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rhonda Degalo. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. We represent the 17 federally qualified health centers in Minnesota, operating 74 delivery sites in medically underserved areas of the state. The health centers provide medical, dental, and behavioral health services, in other words, one-stop shopping for their patients. The health centers serve a very low-income population. 95% of the patients are below 200% of federal poverty guidelines, and 40% of them are uninsured. I'm here today to speak in support of Senate File 1342, which would provide an increase to the health center's state appropriation. The current appropriation is used for a variety of purposes, so long as the Minnesota Department of Health determines it is consistent with the authorizing statute to continue, expand, and improve federally qualified health center services to low-income populations. First and foremost, health centers use these funds to partially offset the cost of serving nearly 70,000 uninsured Minnesotans on an annual basis. In 2012, the cost to serve the uninsured for these health centers was nearly $40 million. While health centers do charge the uninsured on a sliding fee scale, they also rely on grants from the federal and local governments, along with private philanthropy, to maintain their commitment to serving the uninsured. Since the appropriation was established in 2007, the number of uninsured using a health center has increased by over 60%. Secondly, health centers use the funds to invest in their own internal infrastructure to meet the triple aim. For example, health centers are striving to meet the state's healthcare home certification standards, but this requires significant investment into health center operations. Another example is the need to maintain and enhance health center information technology. As we move forward with healthcare reform, it is increasingly important to be able to coordinate care for patients with safety net hospitals and other providers. In order to do that, they need real-time data, and they are increasing their investment in this IT capacity in order to thrive under healthcare reform. Finally, health centers use the funds to support the real key to their success, that being enabling services. These services do just that, enable populations that face barriers to care to overcome those barriers. Examples include transportation services, language translation, and outreach or community education. These enabling services result in better health outcomes for difficult-to-serve populations. For example, health centers have lower rates of low birth weight deliveries by every race and ethnicity compared to state averages. Clearly, these services, partially funded by this appropriation, are helping to promote health equity for our patients. There are many more examples of the uses of these funds, ranging from supporting dental staff salaries to community health workers. To sum up, under health care reform, Minnesota's health centers expect two things to happen. Number one, that those remaining uninsured after 2014 will still seek care at a health center. And number two, total patient volume will actually increase. Therefore, we are looking to the state to help us meet that demand, while at the same time continue the 45-year tradition of cost-effective primary care services that keep some of Minnesota's poorest and diverse urban and rural communities healthy. I thank you for your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Degelow. My question was, and if we could go back perhaps on the appropriation, Senator Hayden, the bill says 3.7 for each year. I thought I heard you say $6 million per year. Is that correct? Is that that's total base funding?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think that my notes didn't match up with the appropriation in the bill. I did say 2.3 to $6 million per year, but the bill says 3.7 in 14 and 3.7 in 15.
And Senator Hayden, you wouldn't know what the appropriation was last year, would you? Or would there anybody that you could bring up on that?
I'm sorry. I didn't hear the question.
Oh, what the appropriation?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenfeld Griffin and I do lobbying on behalf of the FQHCs, and the current appropriation is $2.3 million. This would increase it and make it $6 million. We are trying to move it back in the direction we were in before the last budget cuts. The appropriation was reduced last time around. But as Ms. Degelow said, the demand continues to increase, and we've seen the experience that happened in Massachusetts, which was more coverage for people, but at the same time we saw an increase in the number of uninsured people that were concentrated in FQHCs in that area. We think that that's an appropriate reason to increase this appropriation.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Ms. Degelow. We're going to have approximately 210,000 uninsured after full implementation of the ACA in Minnesota. So you don't anticipate your uninsured population dropping. You anticipate it growing. Is that what I heard you say?
Ms. Degelow?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator, we do expect that the uninsured numbers will drop somewhat. A lot of our analysis has been in regard to what happened in Massachusetts with the community health centers. They did see a moderate drop in the uninsured, but at the same time, they also saw the impact of pent-up demand from people who now had coverage who hadn't had coverage in the past. Again, a very low-income population, and sort of their natural points of access were the community health centers.
Sarah Benson.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Deglow, but those people will have coverage. We've expanded MA. I guess I don't know if there's a fiscal note. I haven't seen one, but I'm not sure where the $3.7 million comes from. What sort of analysis went into why we need this increase in your base funding if there's also expanded MA that's helping your population, the number of uninsured are dropping, and we're doing more work with other safety net facilities. There are a lot of pieces to the puzzle. I'm just trying to figure out why yours is this size.
Ms. Dagelow.
Madam Chair, Senator, the current state appropriation is used for things beyond covering the uninsured. So to the extent that there are infrastructure needs such as IT, needs to hire additional staff to provide the kind of enabling services that allow low-income populations to access care, those are all included as things that are paid for through this appropriation. So we're not just looking at the drop in the uninsured, but the greater demand for services as a result of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act.
Sarah Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dagelow, maybe I need to hone in. Is this number just to get you closer to what you were before, or did you sit down with a board of directors and a finance team and say, here's the IT that's going to be coming and required of us, here are the support services that are going to be required, and this is the number that works?
Ms. Dagelow.
Madam Chair, Senator, actually, I think a combination of both factors. There is the piece of getting us back to where we were before the cuts that occurred earlier. But then in addition to that, we looked at, and not that we tied specific dollar amounts to specific initiatives, because the needs vary so greatly from clinic to clinic. This is really infrastructure support for the clinics to meet the current demands and demands that they know that will be coming after 2014.
And Madam Chair, and this will be my last point, if you know the demands are coming, it would just really help me be supportive of funding if it was, we need these changes to our IT infrastructure. We're going to need this kind of support staff because of the change in volume. That's incredibly helpful to me in deciding if this is good money being spent. Simply because, well, this is where we were before, and then it was cut, we'd like to go back, especially in this very dynamic environment where there have been significant changes. It would be helpful to have a little more analysis in the request.
Madam
Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I think you're right. I think you've kind of started to hone in on the challenges of it is a dynamic environment, and we are, so their analysis on what happened in Massachusetts may or may not be apples to apples to what happens in Minnesota. We do know that I tried to hone in yesterday in a conversation I was having with folks and trying to figure out who the 203 or 30,000 people after full implementation, who those folks would be, and kind of in our continuum that we've set up, if everything works, from, you know, expanded MA, the BHP bridge that we have, and then on into the exchange, who would those folks be? And so as you ask, I think those are the right questions to answer, and we are kind of honing in. The problem is I think that it is fluid and dynamic, but I think what we do know about FQHCs is we know that they are typically the access point, uninsured are insured for low-income people who live in these communities, and we know that regardless to how they come with the subsidy or not, that that's typically where they're going to go and that they've been cut significantly. So I think that there is truth, and we want to get back to where we were because we know that there are folks that we need to take care of, but we also are trying to do the analysis to figure out how many more people we're going to get now that people are going to be insured and don't have the barriers to getting care that they've had before. So I think it's appropriate for us to continue to do that analysis and report to us, but I do think it's very fluid and dynamic.
Madam Chair, to the Senator Benson, if I could just add one short item. The analysis that we've done brings you the numbers of the total dollars of uninsured, uncompensated care that we have. That's far greater than the $6 million that we're requesting here. That's the $40 million number that Ms. Dagelow used. We're not asking the state to make up all those losses. We do private funding, try and balance those things. But what I will be happy to provide you with is a chart that shows the increase in the number of uninsured that we've been dealing with and have not caught up with at all in the past 10 years. That number continues to grow. And in spite of the implementation of the ACA, we think that number is going to be out there. And those people who are going to access through the uninsured are going to continue to be disproportionately in FQHCs.
Any other questions?
I don't think she's convinced.
Any comments? Okay. Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 1342 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Mr. Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Hayden, you know that comment, when the cat's gone, the mice play? I think it's yeah. I have the gavel, and there's only one other Republican at the table. So let's vote.
I was noticing that, but I saw him. I had a little backup in the corner. He peeps over there, Madam Chair. But I was
just
I
choked on his pizza.
See, I had to sit a little clearer there. No, you guys are my friends. I know you'll help me.
Of course we will. Senator Hayden, 1272, please.
Madam Chair, it looks like we're going to take up Senate File 1272 for possible inclusion. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 1272 deals with the healthy homes. In 2012, yes. Hundreds of people from across the state.
Hiding in the wings, right?
Okay, good. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. 2012, hundreds of people across the state helped to develop a healthy home strategic plan for Minnesota. This bill will begin the implementation of this plan so that citizens of Minnesota can realize the many benefits of healthier homes. The impact of the home environment on health has been known for a very long time. There has been increased attention to the impact that home environment has on illness that are problems today, including brain damage, learning and behavioral disabilities, asthma, allergies, injuries, poisoning, and lung cancer. All across the country, there are successful efforts to address housing-related conditions, improving health, and reducing health care and educational costs. Americans spend 90% of their time indoors. Most of that time is in their homes, working with people to improve the health environment of their homes will improve people's lives and save health care expenses for us all. With me today are some people that can describe in more detail what this bill accomplishes for Minnesotans. The Department of Health is available to answer questions as well. So I'll leave it to my testifiers to introduce themselves and tell you about the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. State
members
your name
of the committee.
For the record.
Thank you. My name is Zach Hansen, and I am the Environmental Health Director for the St. Paul Ramsey County Department of Public Health. I'm testifying today in support of this bill and its focus on healthy homes on behalf of the local Public Health Association of Minnesota, which represents city, county, and tribal health departments across the state. Our experience in St. Paul and other cities in Ramsey County is that there is a strong connection between health and housing. We worked hard over the last two decades to address childhood lead poisoning using both primary and secondary prevention tactics, connecting health and housing. The connection between health and housing, I think, is apparent, showing that we've had a number of grants from the Housing and Urban Development Department at the federal level. And so at the federal level, they recognize that connection between health and housing. We've also worked on radon, asthma, mold, chemical poisoning, and injury prevention. And what we've learned is that it makes more sense to approach these things from a whole house perspective rather than from dealing them with them on a one-by-one basis. Now, our experience in healthy homes began with some federal HUD funding in 2006 in partnership with the City of Minneapolis, where we used our experience from lead in connecting homes and health to broaden our work and followed up that work with some grant funding with the American Lung Association of Minnesota. Now, the target of that work was to focus on kids with severe asthma, who generally use the hospital emergency department as their primary care physician. In the same manner, Minneapolis addressed a number of homes. We worked with 163 homes where kids had severe asthma. They were larger, older, single-family homes of areas with lower housing values who had a lot of environmental issues. And our intervention strategy focused on reducing the environmental triggers that kids would be exposed to so that they could get a proper night's sleep and avoid asthma attacks. And while the focus of that work was on asthma, as we were in these homes, we were able to address radon, humidity and mold, pest control, and other safety concerns. And results of that work showed that there was statistically significant improvements in the child's onset of asthma. They had reduced school absenteeism. They had fewer visits to the emergency department. So the kids were in school more. Healthcare costs were down, and the kids were generally healthier, and the parents could go to work. Now, we're also able in that to identify and address other environmental exposures. Now, last year, we in St. Paul Ramsey County were one of seven areas in the state to carry out similar work with funding from the State Health Department. We showed in 26 additional properties that the same approach worked. Now, all seven communities across the state were making good progress towards healthy home goals when federal cuts led to a discontinuation of this work. As the senator pointed out, there's a clear connection between housing and health. Healthy homes are dry, they're clean, they're pest-free, well-ventilated, contaminant-free, safe, and maintained. So a comprehensive approach to housing when it's connected to health has been demonstrated to be effective and efficient. Now, as a finance committee, I know you're concerned about the return on investment from state funds that may go to work on healthy homes. There's folks here from the state that can talk about the return on investment for things like lead and radon and cancer prevention and so on. But from a local level, I can tell you from the human side of that return, in our lead hazard control program, we've reduced the incidence of elevated blood lead levels in kids by taking that healthy homes approach. We've seen over the decades that children that would be exposed to lead no longer are, and so they have a better chance to be smarter and healthier throughout their lives. Lead is not going away as a problem. Last year, we had 233 kids in Ramsey County that tested over the CDC's point of intervention. And by working with those families, we provided a better future for those kids. And also then in our Healthy Homes work on asthma, we've also been able to demonstrate by connecting housing and health, we've been able to increase time in school, reduce health care costs, and help families. So LPHA supports this bill and the early intervention to remove lead hazards and other hazards in the home that it would produce.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Did you have another testifier, Senator Hayden?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
Okay, and I'm going to welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Newman. I'm the Executive Director of Sustainable Resources Center. We create healthy, safe, and energy-efficient homes, and we've been doing that for over 33 years. As you've heard in our testimony, home environment matters a lot. It matters a lot to the lead-poisoned child who suffered brain damage, to the father with an asthmatic child, and mold in the home who's been up half the night and trying to get back to work and be productive the next day. It matters for that senior citizen who fell at the bottom of their steps and broke their hip because they didn't have a proper handrail installed. Our home environment matters a lot because we can't solve major problems in our society unless we also address issues in the house. Health disparities, educational disparities, and keeping seniors in their homes are all priorities for the state. But a child with asthma, the right drugs are good and necessary, but not sufficient if they're in a home with environmental triggers that are causing them to not sleep and wake up in the middle of the night and have asthma attacks and go to the emergency room. Grab bars and ramps are absolutely necessary for elderly people to have access in their homes. But if their water heater is spilling combustion gases into their home every time it turns on, and Mr. it's exacerbating their COPD.
A lot of this was covered by Mr. Hansen, okay, and we did have a hearing on the policy. I think we are pretty well-versed on the policy of this and would agree that it'd be good policy if we can focus our comments on the budgetary issues and try to be brief. It would be very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's four areas of this bill that have been that there's four areas of work in this bill that are have been created by the strategic planning process and the Alliance for Healthy Homes and Communities. So these are areas that have been people all over the state have been involved in making this plan, creating this plan, and promoting this plan. And this is what this bill will promote. One is lead poisoning prevention. There is no safe level of lead for children, and yet the CDC eliminated the funding for the lead surveillance program in Minnesota. We need to keep the lead surveillance going. The bill does that. You can see from the chart that we handed out the success we've had. This bill also provides for case management support for 1,500 lead poisoned children who are known to local public health agencies so that they can get the services they need to address the issues that they have and to prevent lead poisoning. In the area of information and technical assistance, stakeholders identified the need for trusted sources of information, general and specialized training and technical assistance. Attendees in the training classes, such as public health nurses and housing code inspectors, will be assessing over 50,000 homes per year. There's information. Okay. All right. It also supports local leadership with grants to enable local communities to get to work cross-sector and address these issues in their communities. And it provides support for MDH to address the lead issues and to plan and direct healthy home services.
Thank you very much, Mr. Newman. These are important provisions. I know I'm from northeastern Minnesota, represent an area that was really devastated. We had over a thousand homes in my district get flooded. And the mold issues are one that that I'm very aware are going to be plaguing my community for a very long time. That component is incredibly valuable. I know from looking at the research, I know the radon, I know the lead issues from many years of service on this committee, and value the work that you're doing. So with that, any further comments, Senator Hayden?
No, sir, Mr. Chair.
Any amendments?
Not that I know of.
Okay. Any further testimony by members? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves that Senate File 1272 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank
on
you
that,
for your patience.
On that motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hayden.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence.
You're welcome. And then I think we're going to recess until noon and allow members and staff and others to grab a salad, a piece of pizza, a little bit of lunch, and come back refreshed and finish up the 1034 omnibus bill portions that we're covering today. So with that, we stand in recess till noon.